It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Good morning, Casey. How are you?
I'm doing well, Kirk. You're doing better than some parents in the Middleton Cross Plains School District.
So I've heard.
Now, you heard about this? This Middleton teacher who was fired from a middle school in 2010 for apparently looking at some type of pornographic email, or I don't know exactly what it was, but it was
presumably
lines
at the school.
Yeah, well, there was some debate about that, but yeah, I think it was either at the school or on the school computer. And there were seven different district employees who, after a 2009 investigation, they revealed that employees had viewed or shared pornography or sexually inappropriate images or jokes or videos. So it's kind of broad on district computers. And this one particular teacher was fired. The rest of them received suspensions ranging anywhere from 15 days to a reprimand of some sort. And the district says that the content, or their position essentially, was that the content on this one computer was actually more inappropriate than that seen by others. So they basically said that the images or whatever was viewed by him was more inappropriate than the others. And there was essentially there was a dispute about this whole thing. The arbitrator ended up making a decision that that he had been unfairly terminated, this one particular teacher, compared to the punishments received by the others who looked at explicit materials as well, or at least some of them.
Well, let's take a step back. I like taking steps back. You notice how I always introduce my comments by saying, let's take a step sideways. How about that?
Okay,
all right,
that's
this
fine.
Time we'll
let's
take it. It's just a jump to the left. But the issue here that I think is very fascinating is that schools tend to have these policies. The policies are there for a good reason, and it's primarily so that inappropriate material or sometimes obscene material doesn't interfere with the workplace itself. That's number one. Number two, certainly in an educational environment, it shouldn't expose children to harmful materials. And number three, it shouldn't contribute to a form of what could be perceived as a harassing type working environment. But in a situation where you have at least two of those three things not applicable, like let's assume that the employees are not, or they're taking measures to make sure that underage people or students are not viewing inappropriate material. Number two, if it's clear that all people participating in this raunchy activity are consenting and it's not creating a hostile work environment, then we're just left with a policy. And this is one of those things that always presents a problem with regard. It seems to be a recurring theme on our show where we talk about how we have these inflexible policies. But apparently, in terms of what sort of precedent the school may set for punishing other employees, you know what? That's a bed that they make, and then they got to sleep in it.
Exactly.
When it turns out that way. That's actually an issue that can be raised in a variety of different employment law contexts. Well, I know when I was in the military, that was something that always came up when someone was being terminated. I mean a civilian employee, not a military person.
But your point is well taken, because you're saying, what is the harm here? I mean, what is this rule or policy designed to prevent? And I think most people would argue it's designed to prevent children from viewing this activity. Now, you might say,
and there might be more than one purpose in that, but yes.
Yeah, it's also designed to not have employees wasting time by looking at these
types
of images.
Well, I actually disagree with that as a legitimate policy reason, because in today's world where the internet is what everybody does, and it happens in every single workplace. Somebody says, hey, look at this funny YouTube video. I'm trying to do work next door, and you call me into your office and say, Kirk, I got to show you this hilarious video. And I sit there and I watch it and I say, okay, Casey, I got to get back to work now. If we're looking at whether or not that sort of thing interferes with work activity, it certainly does. World we live in.
I'm not saying that's a legitimate thing. I'm just saying maybe that's part of what it's based on. But I think the biggest thing the parents are worried about, right? Because there's some parents, not all parents. I think a lot of parents. I'm from Middleton, as you know, and I don't necessarily know a lot of the parents.
That's why you're all spun up about this story?
Right, because there are a lot of parents who are saying, really, what's the big deal? But then there are others who are saying, That this is just crazy and he ought to be fired. In fact, there was one who wants to petition the governor to see if he can prevent this teacher from returning to work because apparently they feel so threatened by this teacher.
Okay.
Well, he's going to become some kind of, you know, child
molester. Let me make sure I understand. It's totally legal and fine for this guy to, you know, do it on his own time. He can be looking at whatever legal pornography he wants to, as long as it's not illegal. He can have all sorts of fetishes. He could, you know, be into like bondage or whatever, you know, and that's fine because that's his own personal thing. It bleeds over a little bit into work and there's a little bit of, you know, horseplay in the office, and all of a sudden there's a parent concerned about the kid going to a school where this monster is going to be exposed to the kid. You know, we don't have those kinds of protections to keep people that safe. It
and
just doesn't work that way.
He wasn't, there's no allegation that he was looking at anything illegal in the sense that these weren't children.
Oh, we'd be having a completely different discussion if that was the case.
He'd be charged with a crime if that happened, but he's not because he didn't do that. And there's no allegation that this particular teacher has ever been, at least that I know of, has ever been inappropriate with any staff or students or anything like that outside of this context. Now, you can say this is wrong, and as a parent, I do not want my son or daughter being taught by a man who looks at pornography. Fine. If that's your position, you're going to have to disqualify a whole lot of teachers.
Well, not only that, it's just an unenforceable rule. It's completely impractical.
Yeah, and I'm not saying – if you look at society in general – there are lots of people, men and women, who look at adult images of things. And I'm not excusing it. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not making a judgment. I'm just saying
it is what it is.
Right, exactly. And so is this really the biggest deal in the world?
If you know, a lot of these policies, whether it's a school policy or even if it's a business policy in some larger corporations where there's a lot of intermingling with people, especially if it's a cubicle situation or something like that, a lot of these policies go back to when the internet was sort of first getting started and employers had these concerns that people would be wasting a bunch of time. And there was this myth that was perpetuated throughout the employers community that somehow when people are looking at things on the internet that are not solely related to their job, that somehow that's costing the business money. Now, if you're talking about somebody that has a bad habit of constantly wasting time on a computer, that's the same person that's going to waste time chit-chatting around the office,
anywhere,
having too many donut breaks, or reading the sports page while they got their feet up on the desk. So the internet is just a way of people wasting time. And it's the same way you can waste time all kinds of different ways. You know how much time we waste in the office just doing absolutely nothing. But, you know, I think this is something that survives from a previous era when there was this belief, a myth, that somehow every time you click on a link that it's somehow consuming some kind of company resources.
Well, I think, I hate to take this into a more macro discussion about society, but I'm just going to do this for a second. When it comes to, you know, things involving sex or things involving, you know, body parts and things like that versus violence, we as a society tend to view things involving sexual issues as far more serious. And I'm not talking about illegal sexual
things. You mean in America? In the United States.
Versus violence.
It's not really true in Europe, but...
Right. No, I know. But we could be... This teacher could be showing a video. Showing an actual video, by the way, of the most violent, you know, movie that you can imagine. And I'll bet you anything, parents would not get nearly as upset as him looking at an email on his own time that has nothing to do with the kids, and he didn't show it to the kids, and he didn't do anything involving kids.
Or better yet, go back to when, do you know what classroom scare films are? I mean, I don't know if they have them anymore, but
no, I don't.
You know, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, they'd have these films that were
made.
But it's funny, I know that you know this, but our listeners don't. I actually collect these funny little educational films. Some of them are like military, some of them are classroom films, but it's because they're so hilarious, and it's a little snapshot out of time about what our societal attitudes were all about. But, you know, these scare films they used to show, especially ones that relate to drinking and driving or hazardous driving or the responsibilities that a driver has, you know, they'd show accidents, they'd show dead body parts, they'd show blood spattering everywhere, and that's, you know, designed to shock the kid into being a careful driver. I'm not sure how much that really works, but, you know, it's interesting that you're right. We do place a higher premium on trying to prevent things of a sexual nature above and beyond whatever protection that we try to have against things that are gratuitously violent for right. whatever reason. And I think that nowadays there are books that kids read in school that contain violence, obviously.
Well, look at the video games.
Classic literature. Hey, did you ever study Hamlet, for heaven's sake? You know, if you read any Shakespeare, it's fraught with violence.
Well, what about your Grand Theft Auto video game?
Right. Well, I don't think they do that at school. But
no, I know. I'm just saying we're exposed to a whole lot more of it. And you want to know, the district really made this a big deal. They spent $932,000 taking this case, or trying to take this case, all the way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, denied review. So almost $1 million.
That's obscene.
That's obscene. Yeah. And who's going to pay for that? Well, I'm sure
the residents of Middleton.
The residents of Middleton. Right. Right. Which we're not residents of Middleton, but, well, you know. So anyway, this is
that's utterly atrocious.
It's just one of those stories that I think has gotten a lot of attention for good reason, and it's actually made a lot of news around.
Well, it's good because, you know, we finally have a weekend where Justin Bieber is not in the news.
He's in the news.
Oh, he is in the news.
Yes.
How did I miss that?
Yes, he is in the news. Well, we have to.
We can talk about that after the break.
We can. We have to take a break. We'll be right back with more Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL. You know you love me.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. This is becoming a real weird trend, but Kirk and I have been talking about, well, we talked about Justin Bieber last week, and of course we have to talk about him again this week because...
Yeah. Boy, I would just, what I want for Christmas, not Christmas, I know it's past Christmas, my New Year's resolution is to live in a world that doesn't have a weekly Justin Bieber update, or Lady Gaga, or anything like that. Or no, that's not the one I'm thinking of. It's the one who's the twerker? What's her name?
Oh, Miley Cyrus.
Miley Cyrus, yes, the twerker.
Well, Justin Bieber got arrested this week, apparently, and he was down in Florida, and I guess he was at some kind of nightclub, and it was early in the morning, and he was, according to the reports, drag racing in Miami Beach, and he was pulled over and then ultimately arrested
for DUI. That sounds like both a mature and intelligent thing to do.
That's right, and he's 19 years old, so he would be under the legal drinking age. And he was booked at Miami Beach Police Headquarters on charges of driving under the influence, also driving with an expired license, and resisting arrest without violence. That's actually a charge.
Oh, because they have the version with violence and then the version without violence.
Apparently they do in Florida. So after his arrest, Bieber reportedly cursed out the arresting officer and then admitted to having beer, pot, and prescription drugs in his system.
Wow. If you're going to do it, just go all the way.
Yeah, according to the arrest affidavit, Bieber smelled of alcohol, repeatedly dropped F-bombs, and refused to cooperate with a police officer who had ordered him to put his hands on his car during a cursory pat-down.
So he was smoking the old Mary Jane, huh?
That's according to him.
This isn't your parents' pot.
That's right. Now, he was driving either a Lamborghini or a Ferrari.
Reports are uncertain at this
news
point.
Reports
some sort of fancy car.
Well, the other guy he was with was driving the other car.
I see, because it was a drag race.
Yeah. And the star was reportedly traveling 55 to 60 miles per hour, something Kirk Colbert would never do in a 30 mile per hour zone.
That would be 35 miles an hour more than I would ever drive.
And let's be clear about this. In Florida, there is no minimum sentence on a first offense drunk driving. And there is a maximum of 6 months in jail, a fine of $250 to $500, and 50 hours of community service, and other things like that. So Justin Bieber in a whole lot of trouble. Plus, he was apparently under investigation for potential felony charges due to the egging incident
from last week's
that
news.
We talked about last week.
Yeah, and so does he live in California?
I think so.
So he's all the way across the country drag racing someplace while he's high and drunk.
He probably took his private jet and had a lot of fun with that. Kirk,
the Biebs.
This story is right out of Manitowoc County, and I thought it was a joke when I heard it. Okay, I don't know if you've heard about this, but there was a delivery driver, apparently delivering newspapers, who was riding around on a bicycle or tricycle, and he had, according to him, his reflective, clothing on, gear. And so it was at night. And all of a sudden, according to these reports, he gets hit by a car.
Well, he was riding a tricycle?
I believe so.
You mean like a little tricycle, well, like for a kid?
There are adult tricycles.
Oh, you mean a bicycle that has three tires,
that has
therefore
three tires.
It's
yeah,
a tricycle.
Yeah, not like a little kid's thing.
Okay.
No,
I
like
was trying
to picture delivering newspapers, apparently. And so then he's – then – this isn't funny, but it's just so unbelievably weird. He's hit by a 20-year-old driver, and his body goes through the windshield – and he's inside of – part of his body is essentially inside of the car. And according to the reports, according to him, the guy keeps driving. The 20-year-old keeps driving.
Didn't notice that something was wrong?
I don't know if he didn't notice or what was going on, but he kept driving according to these reports. And
You know, if I just have to picture, if I'm driving down the road and all of a sudden there's another person that has gone through the windshield and is half in and half out of my car, I might notice that.
Yeah,
This
according to the Manitowoc newspaper. He said he was returning home from delivering 275 Lakeshore Chronicles when the next thing he knew, he was upside down in the car. He said, I was conscious for the whole time. Everything was in the car except for my knees and feet. I turned to him and said, hello, I'm the guy you hit on the bicycle. He said, I had no idea at all why he wasn't acknowledging me. The driver continued east on Marshall Street, ran a stop sign at South 14th Street, crashed into a vehicle, and kept going. The victim of this, 56 years old, said he was planning to see his lawyer about the accident. But he says he harbors no ill will against the driver. He said, I have no malice towards him. I hope that he can get his life straightened out. He's a young man. He deserves a second chance. But this gets crazier. He says that this guy, after realizing it, said he looked at him and said, who are you? What are you doing in my car? Or in the car. And then
apparently he didn't know the answer to that question.
Right.
So he was investigating.
It was investigation. He then apparently started freaking out, saying, quote, I'm going to jail. I'm going to jail. After the driver locked the car doors, and went home, the guy who was still in the car was able
to... He locks the dude in the car?
Yeah, he was able to
pull
himself...
he'd probably be able to escape through the giant gaping hole in the front windshield, but...
Pulled himself into the car, then gets out, and then, according to reports from the gentleman, there's some passerby who notices this guy who looks to be injured and takes him to the hospital, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so crazy. It's just so crazy that I can't... It almost seems too weird...
Like this might be a fake.
No, I don't think it's a fake.
If this happened in Sheboygan, you'd have no surprise at all. You'd be, oh yeah, just
typical. Oh, that's right.
It's just another day,
and we've got this thing going on.
But that's the shocking thing, is this happened way up in Manitowoc.
Way, way outside of the Sheboygan bubble. So it's way outside
the Sheboygan
outside
weird
that.
Bubble.
Exactly. So can you imagine if this is true, and I don't know if it is, but if it's true and you hit somebody, and they're inside of your car, like through your windshield, and you don't notice. Now
let's do a little role playing. I'm driving the car. You come flying through my windshield. You say, "Hello, I'm the person that you just hit, and I'm inside of your car now." And then I say, "How did you get in here?"
No, but it's
like a Monty Python sketch.
And the only reason we can kind of make light of this is because this guy, the alleged victim in the case, doesn't appear to be too worried about it. I mean, he's kind of like...
Well, he's going to see a lawyer.
Young. Well, he's going to see a lawyer about it.
He's like, I forgive the guy, but I'm going to sue him. I'm going to sue him until I get every last penny from this guy.
He's lucky he wasn't killed or injured. I mean, he said, God is good. He had his hands on me that day. And he apparently did, because I can't imagine being hit.
That's a reasonable conclusion.
That's a reasonable conclusion.
Well, did they say how fast the alleged perp was driving?
They don't. I don't see that here.
Maybe it was very slow.
I
mean, if the guy's on a tricycle, as you say, and maybe it was
fast enough to go through the glass, through the windshield.
Maybe there was no glass. Maybe it was like one of those little toy cars that the guy was like pedaling with his feet.
I believe they showed pictures.
And
I don't
think
it was
a circus.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know what's good about this story, what's nice about this story, is that the gentleman whose bike was ruined is there's a company that's ordering him a new bike.
Oh, how very nice.
Yeah, so it's nice.
Will it be an equivalently of equivalent quality of his lost tricycle?
I hope so.
Okay.
I hope so. I kind of want an adult.
Do you want a tricycle?
Yeah, I think it'd be kind of
cool. That's something that very old people, in my mind, use. 50s. I mean, more than 56, or how old this guy is. I mean,
I'm kidding,
very old ladies riding those things because they it's almost like a wheelchair with pedals. It's like, it right. seems that way. I mean, right. doesn't it? I don't know. It's just in my mind. It seems that way. So you, that's what you want to be.
I kind of do. I think that would be that'd be very interesting.
So I know what you're getting for your birthday.
He just, that'd be great. Thank you, Kirk. He simply had a few scratches on his face, but he was conscious the whole time. That's the thing that gets me, is that this guy was conscious. Now, the gentleman who allegedly ran into him has been charged with OWI causing injury, hit and run causing injury, and leaving the scene of an accident.
Well, wait a minute. If the guy's in the car with him, he didn't exactly leave the scene because the scene is moving with him.
Well,
and not only that, it was a hit and run. It was just hit and the running part.
It's just hit and hit.
If he's got the guy there with him.
I think the leaving the scene part might be if, in fact, he left after going inside of the house. That way.
That might be. Because if you got the guy you hit and it's still in the car. I mean, hit and run means that you left the scene and you left the victim behind who needed help.
Well, yes, that's true. And we know what the law says on this, which is that you immediately need to stop your vehicle
right.
at the scene of the accident or
but
as close to it as
possible. But that's assuming that the guy isn't inside your car.
I know. I don't think that they...
I think he's got a good defense here.
There might be a good defense. And I don't think when the legislature drafted this law that they
thought probably
about.
Some legislators said, hey, wait a minute. What about the scenario where someone's actually inside your car after you hit them? What do you do then?
Yeah.
And there was just no debate on that.
That didn't come up in committee. they didn't actually pass that through. So, Kirk, another thing that I just wanted to get to is this... this Eric Pizer story, just an update on it, because we've been following the story for quite some time.
Yeah, you've been quite an advocate for this guy.
Well, you know, I feel strongly about it. I think he deserves a second chance. And this is a gentleman who was charged with a felony from 2004. I don't think he ever should have been charged with a felony, but that's just that's my opinion. Anyway, he went into the military, served two tours of duty. He came out. He reformed his life. He hadn't had a criminal conviction since. He asked. He wants to become a police officer. He's not able to become one because the governor is refusing to issue any pardons. Well, it just came out this week that the prosecutor on the underlying case, who originally, according to the newspaper accounts, was unwilling to do anything at the start. Unless he re-enlisted, which I think is pretty outrageous. But now he said that he's willing to help him if the law supports it. But he's saying at this time the law wouldn't support it because there is some case law suggesting...
It's like saying, Casey, you can fly around the world if you can sprout wings right now.
Right, exactly. Because it's sort of complicated. But in any case, it's something where he's willing to consider it if the law supports it, but we still need people to try to support this gentleman. And of course, you and I have no vested interest in this other than we care about this guy and we really want him to be granted a pardon. So you can go to pardoneric.com if you want to find out more details. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment with the second half of the show.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Casey, we were just talking about the case of Eric Pizer, and I know that you've been involved with not only drafting a resolution on the part of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, but your article that you wrote was published in several different newspapers and got the attention of quite a few people. One thing that I just want to point out about how the system is so broken, and this particular case just illuminates that fact, is that oftentimes when prosecutors are dealing with a particular case, it's built into the system and it's built into the philosophy as to their prosecutorial decisions that there is that opportunity for a pardon down the road. And when a prosecutor like this one, who, you know, his heart's in the right place, apparently, when is it a he? I'm assuming it's a
yes.
He says that, you know, if the law were to allow it, I would certainly consider some sort of amendment to the charge or some sort of reopening of the charge or something along those lines. But what he's getting at is that the legislature hasn't done enough to actually give that power to the prosecution. And I'm not sure they should, actually, because that would be a bad thing if it really worked that way, because part of what a prosecutor should think about before they charge a case is the probable long-term impact on a person's life. And if they have, well, oh, in 5 years, 10 years, somebody, it could be me, it could be my replacement, it could be somebody after I'm dead, it could be somebody in a different generation, it could be somebody who hasn't even gone to law school yet, in the future, will have the wisdom to reconsider this whole thing. I think it would tend to result in prosecutors having a tendency to overcharge cases and to think that there's yet another safety valve built in the process. Now, you know, having a safety valve is a good thing, but that's why pardons are there for that particular purpose. And, you know, let's be clear, even if Governor Walker were willing to consider, even if he were willing to have a pardon commission formed, which apparently he's not even willing to do that, but if he was willing to actually consider pardons, even in that scenario, very few are meant to be granted. It's supposed to be such a sparingly used remedy. But the point is, it's there. It is supposed to be there. It's supposed to be part of our process. It's part of the checks and balances that we have with the different aspects of government. But you know, you mentioned before that part of the deal was that if he agreed to reenlist, he would, you know, the guy would do something with the charges. And for somebody who's actually served, you know, in combat, to tell them, hey, you got to go expose yourself to more of that, even though you have post-traumatic stress disorder, and even though you've suffered, even though you've probably done all you can do for your country, and even though you risked your life, we'd like you to do that all over again.
Yeah, I mean, that to me was the most offensive thing.
Yeah, it's kind of odd. But you know what? They did used to do that years and years ago. I mean, a long time ago, before my time.
They used to say you need to reenlist.
Well, no, there'd be basically a philosophy that if someone was in trouble, they could forego prosecution and potential conviction and penalties by enlisting in the military. And you know what? The military does not like that idea, but it used to be incorporated as part of the process. I bet there are people listening to our show right now that remember those days when, you know, they had a kid. They had a kid that got in trouble for shoplifting, and the DA says, "Well, tell you what, I'll drop the charges if you enlist in the Marine Corps." You know, and that sort of thing used to happen. It used to happen.
Well. And we'll see, but even former legal counsel Tommy Thompson is urging Governor Walker to reconsider his position on this. So we'll see what happens. It shouldn't be a partisan issue, and unfortunately, I think it's being made into that. Kirk, this was an outrageous story from the Associated Press. Wisconsin corrections officials are saying that an inmate does not deserve compensation for being mistakenly kept in prison for more than a year after his release date.
Come again? What?
Yeah, that's what I said. Robin Gavinsky, 52, is asking the Wisconsin Claims Board for more than $67,000 in compensation for lost wages for spending 417 additional days in prison beyond what his sentence for burglary and other crimes required. Department of Corrections Assistant Legal Counsel recommends in a document filed with the Claims Board that Gavinsky's request for compensation be denied, citing that corrections officials made a mistake in calculating Gavinsky's sentence, but that he had an obligation to draw attention to the error. He said, however,
That
he had the obligation.
Oh, I see.
He
the guy in prison has some sort of obligation.
Yes, he has an obligation to figure that out. It says, however, the claimant and his trial counsel share a significant portion of the responsibility by failing to timely clarify any ambiguity in the judgment of conviction or to correct any mistake made in calculating his sentence. Now, that's odd because his original trial attorney apparently is dead and died before Gavinsky's sentence was mistakenly extended. So, what do we do with that? I mean, this is a situation where this guy spent a whole lot of time.
Let me just make sure I understand here, because, you know, I'm pretty thick sometimes when it comes to this stuff. You got to drill the facts into my head. If they're just not making sense, they're not registering. The synapses are not connecting. So, if I understand this correctly, I could imprison you in my basement for 400-something days, and there wouldn't be anything you could do about it unless you shouted loud enough. Right?
That's right.
Is that what they're saying?
That's about right.
Do I have that part correct already?
You got it.
And if, in fact, because you are under lock and key, and because you are being held against your will, it's called false imprisonment. You know, if you hold somebody, and it's kidnapping. It's the same thing. And if you look at the definition of those things, there is no distinction. Just because you're a prison guard, and it's like saying, oh, the kidnapper, you know what it's like? It's like saying that because the woman didn't scream loud enough when she was being raped, that it's no one's fault. That's what that's saying. It's almost exactly the same kind of argument.
It's a silly argument, and the fact that, you know, you're taking away somebody's freedom for a year. Obviously, they're in a system where they're being looked at on a daily and minute by minute basis in terms of what they're doing. They're being regulated. They're behind closed doors. We have them in captivity.
As human beings, we've got a finite number of years to deal with here.
Right.
I mean, it's like if you had a bank account and you've got $70 in it, they just stole at least one of them.
Right.
You know,
they did steal at least. That's a very good analogy.
Yeah.
That's right. Except, you know, so it's one of those things that,
and
to
you know
me
what?
Is very
Here's another
upsetting.
Thing. He's only asking for $67,000. He's only asking for the lost wages that he could have earned. Are you kidding me? Being held illegally inside of a prison and what that would do to you psychologically and everything else in your life. And besides, you can't give those days back. What is the value of a day of human life? What exactly is that worth to somebody?
Well, that's tough.
And if all he's saying is, hey, I could have worked that year, and that's all I'm asking for is what I would have earned. And they're like, too bad. You didn't scream loud enough when we had you in the cell.
It's amazing. But his case may be included on the agenda of the claims board's next meeting. So we can at least feel comfortable with that idea, Kirk. You know, President Obama made some statements this week regarding marijuana.
Okay? Right.
And
it's not that harmful.
Well, yeah. I mean, he essentially said that it was important for the new laws in Colorado and Washington that legalize recreational marijuana to go forward. He said, and I quote, "We should not be locking up kids or individual users for long stretches of jail time when some of the folks who are writing those laws have probably done the same thing." All right, so essentially he's saying that people who are less economically advantaged.
May I point out the obvious here? President Obama, our good president, is not up for re-election.
In fact,
it's impossible because of the constitutional limitations on – there's a term limit. So if this statement had been made, in, 2009, I don't think it would have had the same tenor. So, you know, maybe this is a good thing about what we call
You're so
a lame
cynical,
duck.
Kirk.
I'm not cynical.
Very,
I'm just
cynical.
I'm just saying, you know, this is going to be – this already is fodder for everybody who dislikes the president.
Well,
you know?
And even including Patrick Kennedy, he's actually come up because he has very strong views on this type of a thing. But yes, Jay Carney, the president's spokesperson, said he's not endorsing any specific move by a state. He's simply making an observation. His position on these matters has not changed. He's basically saying that the president is only pointing out the disparities in our prosecution of our drug laws. And he's not encouraging marijuana.
You know who goes to prison for the longest period of time? In our country, you know, relatively speaking, if you're talking about people that are involved with marijuana offenses, well, people in federal cases,
right?
You know, who's in charge of the federal Department of Justice? The Attorney General. Who does the Attorney General get appointed by? You know,
and poor people tend to get a really big, really hard.
Are spending an incredible fortune on keeping people confined for marijuana type offenses, and we have criminal laws that, frankly, we are wasting time and wasting police resources. You know that there's an organization called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Have you heard about this?
I have not.
LEAP. Yeah, it's people that are either current or former law enforcement officers that are against the prohibition of marijuana because what they have seen and experienced themselves, and would rather have those community resources or tax dollars spent getting real bad guys instead of, you know, kids doing this kind of thing. And, you know, it's just interesting that the president comes out and makes this comment, which I agree with him, actually, you know, 100%.
Right. And,
but the problem is, you know, while we are saying this, we still have federal law enforcement officials in states that have legalization that are enforcing federal laws that are contrary or conflict with state laws. And this is coming down to, and it's going to come to some sort of pinnacle at some point, because if the states go so far as to push an individual right, and I'm not sure we can really say that. We're really saying that they're not going to prosecute,
right. And
that, you know, certain amounts are okay, so you can grow a certain number of plants, you can possess a certain amount, you can go to a store and buy it commercially, and then we get all the tax benefits and all these other things like it. But it doesn't go so far as to say that you have a right, okay? For example, an analogy, driving your car. We have systems in all 50 of our states and our territories, as well as, you know, the entire, at least the Western Hemisphere that I know of. You can go and apply for and get the privilege to drive, and you're permitted to within certain limits. But there is no place, at least within the 50 United States, that you have a right to drive.
Right.
It has never achieved that level. So clearly, people don't have a right to recreational use of marijuana, right?
In Colorado.
In Colorado or Washington.
Right.
But, you know, there is still this conflict in terms of, You can legally purchase marijuana. You can legally sell marijuana in a storefront that says marijuana store, you know, but there are federal laws that make that same legal activity illegal.
That's
and they're
right.
still being enforced.
It's so amazing. Well, that was a good rant, Kirk.
Okay.
And thank we'll
you.
Be back
thank
in
you.
Just a moment with more Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
Listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
One love, let's get together and feel all right.
Hear the children crying.
One love.
Hear the children crying.
One heart.
Saying, give thanks and praise to the Lord, and I will feel.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. And Kirk, I want to talk a little bit more about this discussion regarding marijuana and the president, because I think it's interesting. You know, whenever you have, you pointed out the fact that the president's in his second term, and therefore presidents in their second terms can be a little bit more bold in what they say as opposed to a first term if they're trying to get reelected. And that's absolutely true. And although, you know, I agree with that view. And President Obama did make some statements that I don't think any other president has ever made with respect to marijuana. Now, he did call it a vice. He did refer to it as
sure.
a vice. And he did say, essentially, that it's not good for you. But, you know, a lot of people say that. I mean, you know, you said that the other week. You know, you said we shouldn't be encouraging people to smoke marijuana.
Well, right. It's a toxin. It's something that is not good for our society. It's not something that makes life better for anybody. It's like alcohol in a sense, although technically it's not in the sense. Specifically, if you're looking at
it's not legal.
Well, it's not legal. That's one thing. But also, you know, alcohol is actually a far more destructive substance to put in your body. But you know, there are I don't think anybody out there is saying, "Hey, let's all get high." I don't think that's the issue at all.
Well, do you want to hear what Patrick Kennedy said about it?
What did Patrick Kennedy say?
He said, "I think the president needs to speak to his NIH director, National Institutes of Health, in charge of drug abuse." She would tell the president that, in fact, today's modern genetically modified marijuana, its much higher THC levels, far surpasses the marijuana that the president acknowledged smoking when he was a young person. He said that the government research shows that marijuana is harmful. He said he is wrong when he says that it isn't very harmful, because the new marijuana is not the old marijuana. We need to have presidential decisions made based upon public health and the sound science that the federal government's invested in.
Well, wait a minute. It is true that, I mean, you load it with a bunch of terms, you know, genetically modified. That's like saying that, you know, the tomatoes that you grow are redder because you bought a particular variety that creates redder tomatoes. And at any time you pollinate any kind of plant for it to have future generations, I suppose you're genetically modifying it. But there's no actual genetic modification like what we think of, where they fiddle with the DNA. I mean, that hasn't happened. That's not what we're talking about. But it is true that because of growing efforts over the course of many years, there are ways to basically make the marijuana contain more THC. Kennedy is correct in the sense that today's marijuana is not, you know, the marijuana of 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. But that doesn't make it more dangerous. It's like saying, well, we just had this discussion about Everclear.
Yeah, right.
You know, should Everclear be against the law because of how much alcohol it actually contains? I mean, it packs so much of a wallop that you can't really estimate the impact even a small amount is going to have on you. Point well taken. But you know what? If it were sold legally, and there was a way to put a potency rating on it, just like, you know, they make beer that has like 3% alcohol for people that want it, you know, and you know what you're buying because it says right on it, 3% alcohol, just like you can buy Everclear and it's 195 proof or whatever it is.
Right.
You know, if it says what it is, that's part of the solution to the problem that he's raising. So he's right, but he's wrong in that sense. But, you know, I think the president is actually just acknowledging the fact that, and this is reflected in the views of not only the voting public, but, you know, a lot of states are coming to the same realization that we are wasting time and money on a war that not only will never be won, but that people don't want to fight. You know?
Well, and a lobbyist and co-founder of the Marijuana Majority, Aaron Houston, contributed and said, "There's a certain irony in Kennedy, who admits he doesn't have much experience with marijuana, lecturing President Obama about this, especially when the president was focusing his comments on the need to end the injustices of disparate enforcement."
Right, right.
Which is really what he was talking about.
And he certainly wasn't encouraging people to smoke marijuana.
Right. And that's really how his words, I think, have been twisted in that sense to go forward with that. All right. Now, I've got another thing that I just wanted to talk about. The Greene County, not referring to marijuana, by the way, the Greene County Sheriff's Office.
There's no irony in this story? Or
yeah.
No?
From WKOW in Madison. Says that its deputies and Monticello police responded to a report of a hit-and-run on Sunday morning involving 45-year-old named David Hirschbrunner. The business administrator from Monroe Schools confirmed to 27 News that the driver is the same David Hirschbrunner who is the athletics director for the district. Hirschbrunner was cited for hit-and-run to an attended vehicle as well as operating left of center and was released pending a court appearance. Hirschbrunner's wife is the superintendent of Monroe Schools. District Business Administrator Ron Olson tells 27 News that David Hirschbrunner's immediate supervisor, not the superintendent, will look into the matter. A report from the Greene County Sheriff's Office says that the call of the crash came at 2:28 a.m. on Sunday, this past Sunday. It happened in the 4700 block. Well, you don't care where it happens. Jason Hulsbacher, I think that's how you say his name. He's a 39-year-old truck driver. He was driving, and the SUV then veered left of center and struck the rear portion of the truck. He then reported the crash after the gentleman allegedly left the scene, driving south, and Monticello police found the disabled SUV behind a closed business in the village of Monticello. The sheriff's office says that the passenger was not injured at all. So they apparently another story of a hit and run where you hit some vehicle allegedly and then go off and drive and leave the scene.
You know, it's interesting that we see these stories come up over and over again. Well, I mean, hey, it's happened twice in the same hour, right? You know, we talked about another one just earlier. But, you know, when I encounter this representing clients in this situation, it's most often the case that people don't actually understand what the legal requirement is because it's a little more complicated than you might think. This law is not oriented towards staying put so that you get caught, so that you get in trouble, so that the police can see if you've been drinking or not. It's oriented and focused on, well, you will get in trouble if you've been drinking, but the point is that the duty that one has upon striking another, either an occupied vehicle or a person, is to immediately stop. That's the first step. The second step is that you have to go and see if the person requires attention, and you have to ask. You actually have to inquire. You have to, you know, verbally say, "Do you need help?" And if the person says, "Yes, I need help," you have to get help.
Right.
Either by calling an ambulance or
it's
calling
the
police.
It's almost like a Good Samaritan type situation.
It kind of, except that it imposes that duty. And I think the idea is that if somebody is in a life or death situation, this law requires that you take immediate action if you were involved in the accident. Then you have to remain on the scene. That's the third step, until help arrives or whatever else happens. If the person requests specific medical treatment, you have to do everything you can. Like if they say, "Get me a doctor, I need an ambulance," or, you know, "I need an emergency laryngectomy. Well, yeah, I guess you have to do that. I don't know. Amputate my arm. You have to take whatever reasonable measures are within your power to do that. So it's like a Good Samaritan law, although it is beyond that, because if you don't do these things, if you don't do all of these
criminal
things,
penalties,
then there are criminal penalties. Oftentimes, what I've seen many, many times is that after an accident, even if whether the person's been drinking or not, it tends to be a shocking experience, and it tends to create confusion and sometimes panic. There are times, and this has been, you can imagine all kinds of different scenarios, but I've seen cases where I think this has legitimately happened. Somebody gets hit, or they hit somebody else, but they're not sure who caused the accident, and there has sometimes been a fear that someone is being attacked by a vehicle being used as a weapon. Okay, right. You've seen that before, where right. Somebody flees the scene because of they're in fear of their own safety, and I've seen that occur before. Even if that's the case, the person still has this duty to stop. Even if, let's say, I've imagined this scenario. I've not seen it in an actual case. But let's say you're driving down the road and there's somebody in a Hell's Angel jacket on their chopper next to you, and they've got one of those helmets that has like the spike on it and stuff. And,
oh, there you go.
You know, and they're riding their hog down the road, and something happens where there's a vehicle versus motorcycle.
It's like an Easy Rider type accident.
Yeah, an Easy Rider type thing. And then something happens to the motorcycle dude. You know, if the guy's got a pipe wrench or something in his vest, and you say, "Sir, excuse me, I know that I hit you with my vehicle, but I'm here to render whatever medical attention is necessary under the circumstances," the law would not permit that person to, leave out of fear of their own safety. They're still obligated to stay there and presumably be. And nothing against motorcycle riders. I mean, I know a lot of very, very nice motorcycle riders. But
exactly. Well, let's just. I want to end on this note because we just have to do a brief update on a story that we covered last week involving the Sheboygan Falls basketball players who were initially suspended because there was a thought that there was a gang sign, but in fact what it looks like was a three-point sign that was put up by one of them. It caused a police investigation. We heavily criticized the decision to suspend these two players, and they have been apparently were not suspended. The suspension was lifted. So that's good news, and we just wanted to update you on that story because, of course, following that. But hopefully this situation never happens again in the sense that before we go about and just suspend people
before you label somebody something and don't have the knee-jerk reaction that is prone to embarrass us.
It
made national news.
It was really unfortunate. This has been another edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. You can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. Have a wonderful weekend, and we will talk to you next week.